Zarco. Zarco is Z-A-R-C-O?
Yes.
That's the title of the case that we're talking about, Z-A-R-C-O, so people would know. Any others you want to recommend, Kelsey?
Sure. If people are interested in learning more about the work of GHRC, it's www.ghrc-usa.org. And we have a listserv. We have a lot of information online and through social media, so we invite you to find us there.
Great. That was Kelsey Alford-Jones. Also with us was Gabriela Rivera. Thank you both for coming in, and thank you for your work. And they will be at the World Affairs Council at 6:30 this evening. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives. This program will be available on our website in a little while. Thank you for listening. Stay tuned for the second part of Political Perspectives.
Okay, next up is Anti-War Radio with Scott Horton here on your community radio station, KABU.
I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. Seymour Hersh on his new piece, Returning to the Scene of the Crime. Introducing the great Seymour Hersh from the New Yorker magazine, the man who broke the story of the My Lai Massacre back in 1969, and now he's got a brand new one in the New Yorker about it called The Scene of the Crime, about his recent return there. Welcome back to the show, Cy. How are you?
Okay.
Good, good. Very happy to have you back on the show. Now, listen, we got a real young audience here, and this whole thing happened even before I was born, so can we start, please, with maybe just sort of a small review of exactly what was the My Lai Massacre?
Sure. Actually, it's My Lai, but that's the way they pronounce it there. And everybody pronounces it My Lai. But all that happened was in some areas where the fighting was very intense, promotions were based, you know, if you wanted to get from major to lieutenant colonel to colonel, or even, you know, lieutenant to captain, it was all based on body count, how many kills you had. And so you had an American army that was in Vietnam fighting in a culture it did not understand, against people whose language and skills and way of life that was foreign to them. Our boys weren't particularly well trained in the subtleties of the Vietnamese, to put it mildly. And so over time, inevitably, particularly since for most units in the war, they rarely ran up against regular soldiers. The North Vietnamese, when we were fighting a war, we were in fighting a war against what we thought was the international communism. The idea was that the North Vietnamese were communists and they wanted to take over the South. We were supporting a very corrupt government in the South. This is an old picture that happens to us an awful lot. If you're anti-communist, no matter how despotic you are, we're with you. And we got drawn more and more into the war. It was going not well, never winnable. But we were fighting a guerrilla war in a country we didn't understand, with allies who weren't very dependable. And inevitably, the war, it sort of morphed from a war against, you know, the enemy to a war against the people. And so My Lai was a small hamlet, a sub-hamlet, actually, in Quang Nai province, which is in the northern part of South Vietnam. And Vietnam is now one country. The North won the war in 1975. But before then, it was divided in half. There was an international conference in 1954 in which a division was made, like between North and South Korea. And in the northern part of South Vietnam, there was a lot of support for the against the government. Many of the, we call the people, the guerrillas we were fighting, the Viet Cong, for Vietnamese communists, but many of them were nationalists. They weren't interested in communism as much as they hated the South Vietnamese government. There was also a religious component. Many Vietnamese were Buddhist, and the controlling government was Catholic. And so there was a series of complicated issues. There was a very violent war, and particularly in three provinces, Quang Nai, Quang Tri, and Quang Nam, which were basically marked, in some areas they were marked on American maps with in pink for communists, for red. It's hard to believe now that we were so adamant and so ignorant, but we really thought if we didn't stop communism, if the North Vietnamese communists took over the South, it would be the beginning of what we call the domino theory. All of Southeast Asia would fall to the communists, et cetera, Thailand, et cetera, Laos, Cambodia. And the only problem with that thinking, of course, is that Vietnam and China And also, it would mean that Chinese communism would also be very much more important. All that stuff factored into our decision to put 500,000 men into the war. We lost 58,000 in the war, and the Vietnamese in the war lost anywhere between 1 to 2 or more than 3 million. And so in one day in 1968, a group of American kids in a not very distinguished Army unit known as the AmeriCal Division, sort of a third-rate division. They'd been in Vietnam. They were draftees mostly, and they'd been trained in Hawaii. They went to Vietnam at the end of the beginning of 1968, maybe late 67. They spent 3 months, living in the boonies, not getting good food, not getting great showers. You know, they were humping it. They were the expendables. They were the bottom of the pit for us. And the company lost about 20 men to snipers and bamboo pits, pits with the bamboo sticks with poison on them, all sorts of stuff. Never met the enemy. Never had a set-piece fight. Never saw, because they were fighting irregulars, they were fighting a war against, as we say, a guerrilla war. And we began to think that they were farmers by night and guerrillas at night, so the American soldiers began to start beating up farmers, this particular group, Charlie Company, it was called. And they were very poorly disciplined, really out of control. They were part, in 1968, there was going to be a big attack. We had intelligence in March of 68, March 16th, that there was going to be a Viet Cong battalion, a real group of Viet Cong, lousy intelligence, it was always lousy intelligence, in this village called My Lai that was known to be pro-communist or pro-Viet Cong. And so this company, part of a task force, there were two companies that went on an attack, but Charlie Company, the one that did the atrocity, one of the companies that did it, Charlie Company was given a briefing that said, you're going to meet the enemy, take no prisoners, all the civilians will leave in the morning. It's just phantasmagorical stuff. I don't know where that intelligence briefing came. It was just lousy stuff. But the kids, to their credit, these kids who didn't know much about anything, were high school kids, young, ignorant, had learned to hate the enemy because they never saw him. They were frightened of them, but they also wanted to kill him. They got up in the morning at 3:45, to their credit. They did their toking and they did their, shooting up and they did their drinking, as guys did, although nobody wants to admit to it. And they got on choppers to go kill and be killed. You got to give them that much due. They went there, but of course there was no enemy there. They were just, more than 500 women and children, some old men making breakfast. They got there around before 7. And for some reason, they just went nuts. They rounded up people in some cases. They executed more than 400 people. Some escaped. A lot of raping. They just killed everybody. It was a horrible mess, and it was known. As the killing went on, various officers, ranging to the major general, a guy named Coster, in charge of the division, were circling above watching. A deputy, the commanding general was a two-star. His deputy, a guy named Young, was a one-star. There was a colonel named Henderson who was in charge of, they're all in charge of units up the chain of command. It goes, from a platoon to company, in this case to task force, and then to a brigade, and then to, a one-star general. And they all watched. They just killed everybody that day and went on the next day. That's the way it was. And continued the war. And everybody in the division, or most people knew, it was their day was 407 men, women, and children slaughtered. The task force had another company called Bravo, which attacked a village, a sister village, about a mile and a half, maybe 2 miles less than that, away, and killed 90, executed actually 97 people there. So one task force of a couple of companies on one day killed 500 people. It got passed. It got covered up. This is the March of 68. In March of 69, a guy named Ronald Ridenour, a wonderful kid who was not in the unit, but he was a soldier, a reconnaissance soldier, happened to fly over that area the next day over My Lai and saw the smoke, I guess the leftover bodies, and knew what a mess it was. Some of the bodies were buried then. And he waited till he got out. Everybody was afraid to do anything. You don't report war crimes. There's no such thing as a war crime then, just mistakes. And Ridenour wrote a letter that began an inquiry, but nothing much happened. The army was very slow going, and finally that fall, 69, 18 months later, I'm a freelance reporter then. I covered the Pentagon, but then I worked in 1968 as a press secretary and speechwriter for a guy named Gene McCarthy, who ran as an anti-war candidate against the sitting president for the presidential nomination. He ran against Johnson and did well, almost defeated Johnson in New Hampshire, and Johnson quit because he knew the anti-war stuff was really bad. And I did that, and I went off to be a freelancer. And in late 69, somebody called me with a tip about this, and I just sort of believed it. I've been following the war. I knew that how bad things were. And from my years of covering the Pentagon for the AP, I also knew from soldiers, some officers, that a lot of murder was going on. I just believed the story and eventually found my way to the infamous, famous Kelly, the sort of the leader of the killing. Every officer in the company, there were five or six lieutenants, was killing, but Kelly was the most outspoken and most aggressive. Had men gather people into ditches and then order them to kill. And so I spent a lot of time, had a lot of trouble getting to Kelly. I finally found who the Army, although they were prosecuting him and they were investigating it by this time because of the letter by Ridenour, it was all done very slowly. I think the Army's goal was to convince Kelly, who was the fall guy, to plead guilty to manslaughter. But he wasn't doing it. I had a lawyer. And eventually I got into it and I found Kelly. I found his lawyer. Wrote a story that nobody wanted. What else is new? There was a little anti-war news agency called Dispatch News Service that was running stuff out of Vietnam and Southeast Asia that I'd written for as a freelancer. And I got into the story, got to Kelly. Nobody wanted it, as I said. And I took it to Dispatch, and they put out, in 5 weeks, I wrote five stories about it, each one worse than the other. And all the newspapers eventually, started buying it. They began to write their own story, and it all was correct. And I, fame, fortune, glory. I got all my prizes, all sorts of prizes. But I went on because I knew that just writing about the massacre wasn't enough. I knew that there had been a systematic cover-up. And I wrote a second book about it for the New Yorker in 1972 that was excerpted, two long pieces. So it was a horrible event. The charge against Kelly was initially that I found a piece of paper that said he was accused of killing 109 Oriental human beings, which is a really strange thing to say, as if somehow 10 white human beings equaled one Oriental. As soon as I wrote it, in the first story I did about Kelly, the Army changed the charge to killing 109, or was 111 human, deleting the word Oriental. Very racist idea. But so was the war. And so it was shocking to America. America, the America that I grew up with, I was in my early 30s in 1969. We didn't know much about what really went on in war. World War II was censored. We didn't see pictures of American dead. We didn't see pictures of the burned and maimed Germans and Japanese we killed. We didn't see that. We weren't allowed to see those pictures. So we really didn't have a good sense of war. And then, as luck would have it, when I began to write my stories about My Lai, an Army photographer named Haberly, who'd been assigned to cover that mission, it was supposed to be a big event that day, also did shoot some pictures for the Army in black and white, but had a private camera with color, and he took the pictures of the massacre. Unbelievable pictures that when I wrote my story, he gave them to the Cleveland Blaine dealer. And in the middle of my stories, all of a sudden, here came these pictures from Haberly about a ditch full of bodies and other atrocities, incredible murders, it depicted. And there's nothing like a picture. So that all added up to a great controversy in America, a lot of anger about whether the story should have been written, et cetera, et cetera. But the mainstream press, to its credit, got into the story, got me started, I guess, in a way, as a serious player. But also, for the country, it was very shocking. We always thought we fought wars a little better, a little differently than the Nips, the Japanese, and the Krauts, as we called them, in World War II. Of course, the Holocaust was the Holocaust. But in combat, it turns out that all war is horrible. All armies kill. All armies do brutal things. All armies hate the other people. We've seen examples of that in Afghanistan and in Iraq, the atrocities. And as some of your audience know, I'm the guy that wrote about the Abu Ghraib prison, the way we treated prisoners there, the nakedness and the sexual abuse and the horrible ways we tortured prisoners. It's all part of a horrible, grimy package. But as awful as Abu Ghraib was in 2004 for most Americans and shocking, My Lai was probably even worse because we really just didn't know. how bad it was and how brutal we could be. We always thought American boys had a higher standard. So it's receded in memory now, although I will say this piece I did is being tweeted all over. It's a lot of bounce to it. There's a lot of sort of residual historical interest in it. As you know, it's called a Return to the Scene of the Crime.
I'm aware that a lot of the right kind of rallied around Cali and said it's no big deal, but I think you kind of make the point in the piece that this really was a big deal for the anti-war movement in the United States of America, that this was kind of a turning point, sort of like when they found out about the secret bombing of Cambodia, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I wrote this story in late 69, November and December, and by 70, the campuses were going crazy. If you remember, there was some of your young kids would even know that in May there was a demonstration at Kent State University, and National Guardsmen actually shot four student demonstrators. They panicked out. And so it became a big thing in terms of the anti-war movement, this kind of atrocity, no question. Absolutely. It was you're right, there was a tremendous amount of visceral support, particularly in the South. Cali was a Southern boy. He'd been in Florida, went to junior college in Florida. I think he was out of North Carolina. In any case, Lieutenant Cali, who was the only one who spent time, 14 officers ranging up to a two-star general were accused of various problems, you know, dereliction of duty. But Cali was tried. He was the only, he went through a court-martial. And in spring of 1971, a year and a half after the first stories, Cali was found guilty of the murder of 21 innocent civilians by his peers, by an army jury composed of senior officers, not all seniors, but majors and lieutenant colonels, etc. And so all of the feelings that many people had, that this was unfair, that Cali was only doing his job, and this all this stuff about mass murder was an exaggeration, sort of disappeared. My story had some impact, but the actual conviction of Cali, after that, Richard Nixon's, the war was over, basically. Richard Nixon had been able, the president who replaced Johnson, Nixon was able, had been able to rally what he called Middle America. He could say, I need your support. But after this, Middle America was gone. They supported him on the war, and it turned out we were mass murdering people. So I think cumulatively, yeah, what I wrote, but also the Army's prosecution of Cali and conviction, it made it a dead man walking.
Right. All right, now I just wanted to read this very small portion of the piece so that people understand here. You say 504 victims from 247 families. 24 families were obliterated, 3 generations murdered with no survivors. Among the dead were 182 women, 17 of them pregnant. 173 children were executed, including 56 infants. And 60 older men died as well, were killed as well. Little bit of a taste of what that number really means when you say 407 killed. Yeah, those are 407 individual human beings, all right. Now, let me ask you about Cali and the actual massacre itself. He obviously, as you say, he was the only one prosecuted for it. But you mentioned there the generals were flying around in the helicopters above. And in the story, you say that at first they just had the at least one group of villagers kind of rounded up and held under watch in the middle of a village for a while. Cali walked away. He came back and said, okay, kill them all. And I wonder whether you think or do you know whether those orders came from anyone above him or not, or it was just he decided, let's go ahead and do this.
Well, let's put it this way. You know, that's an amazing moment because there was a young boy named Milo. What made the story, and Paul Milo was somebody I heard about when I began to do this story, because he was a farm kid from New Goshen, Indiana, got drafted. I talked to his brother the other week before the story ran, and his brother told me that His brother was afraid of blood. I mean, he was the last guy to go to war, but he was drafted and he went in. And when they went into the village, they around there were 3 platoons. Cali was a platoon leader, a platoon, let's say A, and put the B and C, the second and third platoons. They just went around on this not a big village, but they had each had a section. The other guys just went through house to house and just shot and raped and murdered. Cali rounded up people and put them by a big ditch and told Paul Milo to take care of them. So Milo and another young boy from Texas did what American kids do. They had a bunch of kids and women they were supposed to take care of. They gave the kids candy, and they horsed around with them, played little games with them, and told the woman and where to sit. And Callie came back, and he said to Milo, "What are you doing? I told you to take care of them." He said, "Well, I am." He said, "No, I mean waste them." And Milo was stunned, and I didn't know this when I first did my reporting. I only learned this when I went back to it. I went back to My Lai. I didn't want to go. I'd been to Vietnam as a journalist for the New York Times a couple of times during the war in Hanoi and in Saigon. I never wanted to go back to My Lai. I just didn't want to. But my family had been, for 30 years, been pushing me hard. And finally, I said, okay. You know, it's a great tourist place now, Vietnam. And so we went, and I spent a couple of days at the My Lai. It was very tough to do, but I went to the village, and it reminded me of all these things. And Callie told Milo, waste them, and Milo began to cry, but he did it. He shot bullets into them. And so, you know, and all of this, as you said, is being observed by officers, all of whom in real time covered it up. And the general whose name I mentioned, General Koster, by the time my stories got written, a year and a half later after this event, was going to be promoted to a 3-star lieutenant general and was at the time, get this, commandant of West Point. The military, the Army's elite military academy, where most of their future generals go through their college education and early military training. So it was a huge friggin' mess for the military, plus the fact that so many senior officers were obviously aware of it. The story was, even though many knew what was going on and many knew how bad it was in real time, one helicopter pilot saw what was going on and landed and actually had his gunners put their guns on Lieutenant Callie. He was going to throw a grenade into a ditch full of people. And instead, they're broadcasting this. It's on the airwaves. It's on the radios in the headquarters, and everybody else listening can hear this conversation. He tells Callie if he makes a move to go another move, he's going to kill him. He's going to have his gunners open up on him, and he takes the Vietnamese hiding in a ditch and flies them out. It was in a small gunship. He made a couple trips to fly them out to safety, the civilians. All of this was reported. All of this was a mess. Mm-hmm. And yet, a day later, the official report on the front page of the New York Times, as relayed by the command in Saigon, was, big victory in the village of My Lai. They called it Pinkville. 128 Vietnamese Viet Cong killed, 3 weapons captured, all in the front page. So it was just a mess.
Yeah, Hugh Thompson Jr., that helicopter pilot, and that's what really stopped the massacre at that point, right? Was his intervention?
Well, it was sort of, they were done massacring. There weren't many left because, you know, 100 people or so escaped and fled, but the others were just killed. It was hard to believe because Army units had gone through the village before and, you know, not done this. But one of the things you have to know is that there was nothing of this scale before, but killing 60, 40, 80, 100, as happened in the sister village, was going on all the time.
Right. Going on
all the time.
That was one of the things I wanted to ask you about. There's this new book by Nick Turse, Kill Anything That Moves.
Sure.
And he talks about this.
Nick did the book a couple of years ago.
Right. And, yeah, not that new, but relatively new, where he's gone through and he got all the documents from the Army war crime investigations. That's where he found it. And he basically says, My Lai is exceptional because it became such a big story because of Hirsch's reporting and because it was so many people killed just in one spot. But otherwise, people should understand that the Vietnam War is basically a My Lai massacre every day.
Well, you know, Nick wrote about other horrific areas in the Mekong Delta and elsewhere, other areas where they were incredible. Here's the issue. The issue was, and this is something that Nick writes about too, is the issue was that in Vietnam there just was no such thing as a war crime, apparently. You know, there was a violation of rules. But the idea that you would walk into a village and slaughter everybody, well, that wasn't a war crime. That was just a mistake, over-aggression. And there was something that emerged from the war called the MGR, the Mare Gook Rule, which was a basic defense that, you know, if you were caught killing somebody, the Vietnamese, well, they were merely a gook. Mare Gook Rule, it was called. It was an informal sort of explanation. And so if you're a company commander, let's say, and you're a captain, you want to make major, and this is the only life you're going to have, you know, you're not on the outside, you're not going to be able to cut it. You didn't get through college, but here the Army's helped you out and made you a captain. and your guys have gone off and killed everybody, you had two options. You could begin a war crimes investigation and ruin your career and everybody in the chain of command, or you could simply do the best you can, cover it up, and find some number to report that's high, like 128 Viet Cong, that'll help your career. And that's what happened. That was the choice that happened. I'm afraid to say the same kind of stuff. We're not talking about the same degree of killing, but on a day-to-day basis, there certainly hasn't been enough prosecutions of war crimes or suspected war crimes in Iraq, in the Afghan war. A lot of bad stuff happens. It happens in all wars. There's nothing special about Americans in that. And, you know, we like to think there is, but there isn't. You know, we have a lot of good little guys, good guys who fight the war right. But this particular division, the AmeriCal division, was known throughout the Army as not being el primo, being sort of a dumping ground. And their small unit leadership was just horrible. It was just a disgrace. And, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, you can shape one of the things about young boys in the military. You can shape them in such a way that if you're not at all interested in the rules and fighting, you know, fighting honorably and fighting correctly, you can shape it in such a way that a melee is almost inevitable.
Yeah.
And so that's what happened. We had really a collapse of leadership in the Army. Inevitably, when you're in the kind of war we are, the same sort of, you know, it's not as if we have much of a learning curve. When you're in Iraq or you're in Afghanistan, you're fighting in a country with, and you don't know the language and you're not particularly coached in the culture. You don't really, you know, we have tremendous problems with our soldiers who, in the Arab world, you don't go into a house without being invited. You don't go into the women's quarters without, you know, you just don't go. You're not invited. You're not there. And you certainly don't go through their personal effects. You don't go looking for whatever they look, guns, by tossing through clothes in the women's quarters. And we make, you know, we just do culturally despotic things that turn people bad enough. We bomb them. Bad enough we have drones. But in the field, we do so many things that aren't conducive to gaining support, even from people who might otherwise be interested in seeing people like Saddam Hussein get overthrown. We ended up just creating a great animus towards us.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, Scott. Bye-bye. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too, sir. All right, Shell, that is the great Seymour Hersh, the author of Me Life 4, a report on the massacre and its aftermath and cover-up, the Army's secret investigation of the massacre at Me Life 4, and, of course, many other books, including Chain of Command, The Road from 9/11 to Abu Ghraib. The new piece is at thenewyorker.com. It's called The Scene of the Crime. All right, y'all, and that's Anti-War Radio for this morning. Thanks very much for listening. Again, I'm Scott Horton. You can find all my interview archives at scotthorton.org, and you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show.
Portland school board elections are May 19th. What's your question?
This is Hyung Nam. I'm a Portland Public Schools teacher. I think one of the most important questions to answer, misleadingly simple, but very important, is what do you think is the purpose of education?
Tune in to KBOO April 27th through 30th at 5:45 for special school board election coverage.
And it is a couple minutes before 10 a.m., coming up, of course, will be Air Cascadia with Chris Andre, and that is followed by Flashpoints at 10:15. Today, Flashpoints features coverage of yesterday's Stop Police Violence actions, and we hear an excerpt from a talk by writer Eduardo Galeano, who died this week. And at 11, it's the KBOO Food Show. You won't want to miss that, with Chris Siegel and Rachel Bennett. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, April 15th, as we all know, 2015. And you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. We're going to try out a little experiment today. We'll be speaking. Our guest today is Cassidy Sharp with Greenpeace, with a recap of the amazing and extraordinary action. Greenpeace is known for some of these things, so is Sea Shepherd, but this recent boarding and occupying of a shell, an octagonally shaped, extremely awkward, cumbersome Shell Oil drilling platform destined for the Chukchi Sea. They boarded it, and as I said, camped out on it 6 days in extraordinary weather, terrible seas, and the supplies were difficult, if not absolutely unavailable. Then they returned to the ship Esperanza, and Cassidy Sharp is going to join us in just a moment, if all of this works out okay, to talk with you about that, let you know exactly where we are now and what Greenpeace's next move is going to be. So hang on, and let's see what we can do here. And away we go. So if you haven't seen the video yet, it's very much worth having a look. It's pretty much, of all of these things, as I said before, watching them board, they're finally in the end and rappel down the side of the ship and got back in the Zodiacs and returned to the Esperanza. And now Greenpeace is, as of all, as always,